Hello and welcome to the State of Working America podcast. I'm your host, Nick Kozlarich at the Economic Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank focused on creating a just and sustainable economy for workers and their families. As we start a new year, today we're looking back at one of the key trends in 2023, a re-energized labor movement. In the past few months, auto workers, actors, hotel workers, baristas, and delivery drivers, just to name a few, have stood up for better pay and working conditions. As a result, nearly a million unionized workers got a double-digit pay raise in 2023, according to CNN. Meanwhile, workers are filing petitions for union elections at the highest rates since the 1950s. And the latest Gallup poll shows that 67% of Americans approve of unions, nearing record highs. So what could this surge in labor actions mean for 2024 and beyond? To discuss, I want to welcome Heidi Shierholz, president of the Economic Policy Institute, and former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. Heidi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for this discussion.
I want to start big picture. Why are we seeing a re-energized labor movement right now? Unemployment rate has been below 4% for quite some time. How much is a tight labor market contributing to the wins for workers that we've seen?
The increase in organizing and union activity has absolutely been fueled by the tight labor markets. Unemployment has actually been at or below 4% for the last 2 years. Those are really tight labor markets, and that really matters. And the key reason I think that matters, or a key reason, is that because even though it is technically illegal for workers to be fired for organizing, our labor law is so unbelievably weak that the consequences to an employer of illegally retaliating against a worker for union activity are just a slap on the wrist. It happens all the time. So it is incredibly risky under current law for workers to engage in union activity. But the tight labor markets make it somewhat less risky, because if workers are actually illegally fired, they are more likely to be able to find another job in a reasonable time frame, and that's huge. I think it's played a big role. But I do think that the tight labor markets aren't the only thing that's going on here, that's sort of behind this resurgence. I think the public conversation that's going on right now around unionization and the high profile strikes that we're seeing is creating momentum. People are learning through seeing strike activities, through seeing this broader union activity and the conversation around it. People are learning the importance of joining together with their coworkers to demand changes. I think, you know, now when people see something that's going on in their workplace that's not as it should be, when they're not being treated fairly, now I think you better believe they're at least going to be thinking about whether they might want to form a union at their workplace. And, you know, some share of them actually do that, and that's going to really matter. So that's another key thing. The sort of momentum around this is feeding on itself. And then there is also support like we have not seen for a very, very, very long time from the administration. President Biden went to a UAW picket line. A sitting president has never done that. I think that kind of support has certainly added to the momentum around this, you know, interest in unionization and union activity. One question I do get around this regularly is, will this energy last if the unemployment rate rises? And I do want to say, just to be clear, I do not think that the unemployment rate will rise anytime soon. We're not seeing any signs of that. In fact, quite the opposite. But we have business cycles in this country, and it will rise eventually. So I think this is a really good question to consider. But I don't think you can put this sort of larger conversation back in a box. I believe people have learned lessons about the importance of collective action that won't just go away if the unemployment rate rises. And one thing to me that really speaks to that is that there has been a particularly large increase in support for unions among young people. There's a generation of people that are growing up seeing the importance of collective action during really formative part of their development. And that gives me hope that this really will have staying power, you know, across business cycles through the next recession and beyond.
What does the increase in strike activity and union organizing mean for workers and their families?
That's a really good big picture question that the answer to is really straightforward. The main thing this means for workers is higher pay. Like the contracts coming out of these strikes and threatened strikes are seeing much larger increases than earlier contracts. So there are big wage increases across the board. And I will also say that there have been particularly large increases for workers who companies had sort of successfully separated off and marginalized, like part-time workers at UPS, like workers who had been in the lower quote-unquote tiers at the automakers. Those workers have seen particularly large increases in pay. There have also been improvements in safety and health protections, like air conditioning in UPS trucks. Just really basic stuff that workers hadn't had before that they're winning now. There's also been, you know, increases in paid time off and just other kinds of things that are related to the quality of the jobs. And these gains, they're just a really big deal to the workers, to their families, and to their broader communities.
Can you also talk about how non-unionized workers could benefit as well from what the gains that we're seeing for these striking workers or those taking labor actions?
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive perhaps, but these actions that we're seeing also matter for workers who are not in unions. And you can, the economists call that the, you know, spillover effect of strong unions, and you can see that spillover effect just absolutely playing out in real time right now. So the key example is factory workers at Toyota, Honda, and Hyundai didn't strike. They aren't even unionized. But after the big pay hikes at GM, Ford, and Stellantis as a result of the strikes in those companies, Toyota, Honda, and Hyundai workers also got increases. That's the spillover effect. And when I think about sort of the theory behind the spillover effect, that effect can come from two key sources. So one is higher wages in union companies can mean that non-union companies just have to pay better to get and keep the workers that they need. That can particularly be at play when there's a certain area that has a very high degree of unionization. What I think is probably more likely at play in the auto sector in particular right now is that employers will often pay higher wages to keep their workers from organizing. So that is also known as like the union threat effect. And I will, I think it's useful to point out Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, has made that union threat effect really, really explicit. I mean, he has said, and this is a quote, "When we return to the bargaining table in 2028, it won't just be with the big three." And when he says the big three, he means GM, Ford, and Stellantis, but it will be with the big five or the big six. I think it's hard to believe that those kinds of statements, that kind of intention, didn't play a role in the wage increases at Toyota, Honda, and Hyundai. I am absolutely sure that it did. And then I think it's also useful to think about how the big successes of these strikes could have impacts that actually last beyond the workers of today. And that is because they're just more broadly increasing interest in unions.
Yeah, that is such a crucial point as well. I also want to talk about how the energy around unionization relates to the conversation going on in this country around racial justice. Can you speak about that a little bit more?
Yeah, unionization is just absolutely directly relevant to this really urgent national conversation around racial equity and racial justice. If you just look at the numbers, Black workers are more likely than white workers to be represented by a union. The union density of Black workers is higher than white workers. And while all groups of unionized workers get a pay boost from being in a union, Black workers who are in a union get a larger boost to wages from being in a union than white workers do. And I, you know, the mechanism for that is not totally pinned down, but it's likely due to like a bunch of different things. But I think one key thing is likely that the structures that unions often put in place just make it more difficult for employers to discriminate. And all those things together mean that unions really matter for racial economic justice. They help narrow the Black-white wage gap. And I think it's also worth pointing out that research shows that that phenomenon isn't new. It was like by 1950, Black workers were more likely to be in unions than white workers and had a larger union premium than white workers. Union premium meaning the like pay boost as a result of being unionized. So this goes way back. And then but when you start talking about 1950, it's also worth acknowledging, like sort of stepping back, it is absolutely true that segments of organized labor, like nearly all institutions in the United States, exhibited racial bias well past 1950. And it is also true that the overall effect, because of the things I talked about, the overall effect of that sort of mid-20th century spread of unionization was that the institution of collective bargaining was one of the most important institutions in this country for advancing racial economic justice. And then the flip side of that is a nightmare. The flip side of that is that the decline in unionization has played a big role in the expansion of the Black-white wage gap over the last four decades. And I think it's worth dwelling on that last fact for just one split second, because I think it's something most people don't quite get or understand. I think a lot of people think that, you know, sort of, well, maybe the Black-white wage gap isn't improving as fast as we'd like, but it surely has improved over the last 40 years. That's not true. It has not improved. It has actually gotten worse over the last 40 years. And I think one key reason for that deterioration of the Black-white wage gap, the fact that that has gotten worse, one key reason is the decline of unionization over this period.
You've talked about the union membership rate being lower. Right now it's at 11.3%. It's under half what it was roughly 40 years ago. Can you explain why that is and what additional steps need to be taken at the federal and state level to more closely align this public support, you know, 67% of Americans approving of unions, with union membership rates?
Yes, that is a really important question. And the way I like to sort of crystallize that question in my mind is that there is a massive gap between how many people are in unions and how many people report that they want to be in a union, how many people say that they would sign a union card in their workplace tomorrow if they could. What is causing that gap? That gap is policy. That gap is labor law not effectively supporting workers' right to organize. And it's just the case in this country that after decades of just relentless attacks on unions, our labor law is now so weak that union busting is just a cost of doing business for most companies. And it's a pretty minuscule cost at that. And just to give you an idea of truly how weak our labor law is, if an employer is found to have fired a worker for union activity, which is illegal, all that happens to them is that they must reinstate that worker. They must pay them the back pay that they missed while they were fired. minus any wages that they earned at another job in the meantime. It is nothing. It is laughable. It is not a consequence. So what we need is fundamental labor law reform that will actually make it possible for workers who want a union to get a union. And here's another piece of this, for workers who have gotten a union to get a contract. And that last part is, you were seeing the importance of it right now in what's going on at Starbucks. Starbucks fought unionization at their stores tooth and nail, but they lost. And now there are hundreds of Starbucks stores that are unionized. But here's what happens. Here's the sort of next page in the union busting playbook. If a union busting company like Starbucks doesn't manage to stop a union from being formed, the next thing that they do is drag their feet on negotiating a contract. And there's basically nothing in the law right now that stops them from dragging their feet essentially indefinitely. So they can, there's this next move they can take to make sure that even though those workers have a union, they still don't have the protections of a collective bargaining agreement. It's maddening. The law just simply does not protect workers' rights to organize. So at the federal level, what we need is, as far as this sort of fundamental labor law reform I was talking about, the first steps are the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which will help fix these problems in the private sector, and the Public Service Freedom to Negotiate Act, which focuses on the public sector. And then when we talk about federal change, we have to also acknowledge that the political realities at the federal level are pretty dire. So we also need strong state and local action. Key things that can happen there are overturning so-called right to work laws. That recently did happen in Michigan. The Michigan's right to work law was overturned, which is very good news. And the other key thing that can happen at the state level is passing laws that support collective bargaining for public sector workers. The sort of key thing in all of this is that we need fundamental policy change to ensure that the public policy that we have actually supports unionization instead of what it is now, which is honestly a massive impediment to unionization. We really do need fundamental policy change to make sure that the sort of cultural shift that we've seen in the public discussion and the union activity in the last couple of years actually becomes a permanent path towards greater unionization. It's going to take policy change to really see that happen.
Heidi, thank you again for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And for more information on the state of the economy and the re-energized labor movement, visit us at epi.org or follow us on social media on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. Thank you for listening to the State of Working America podcast.